out the window. Antonio says, "Ah, my lord, my lord." And the count says, "What's the matter?" Antonio, "What insolence! Who did this? Who was it?" Oh, yes, he's usually holding a handful of crushed carnations in his hand. Susanna, Countess, Count Figaro, "What do you say? What ails you? What's happened?" Antonio says, "Listen, listen." And they all say, "Speak up then." And he says, "From the balcony overlooking the garden, I see a thousand things thrown every day. And just now, maybe worse, I saw a man, my lord, thrown down." And the count says, "From the balcony?" And Antonio says, "Yeah, look at my carnations." Cherubino landed on the flowers. The count says, "Into the garden?" Antonio says, "Yes." And the women say, "Figaro, help us now." And the count says, "What do I hear?" Susanna, Countess, Figaro, "That fellow disconcerts us, that old drunk. What's he doing here?" Meanwhile, the count continues talking to Antonio. "A man, you said, but where's he gone?" "Well, the rascal was off in a flash and out of my sight." Susanna, "You know that the page..." Figaro says, "I know everything. I saw it happen." So Figaro laughs. "Ha, ha, ha, ha. Hold your tongue there," says the count. Antonio says, "What's so funny?" And Figaro says, "You're drunk from dawn every day." Meanwhile, the count wants the story. "Now repeat to me, a man from the balcony," "Yes, from the balcony, into the garden," "Yeah, into the garden." Susanna, Countess, and Figaro still trying to distract him. "But my lord, it's the wine talking." And the count says, "Go on just the same. Did you see his face?" And Antonio says, "No, I didn't." And the count says, "You didn't?" And Antonio says, "I didn't see him." So Figaro steps in. "You maudlin old fool, keep quiet a moment. Making such a fuss about nothing. I can't keep my secret any longer." All right, he goes for it. "It was I who jumped into the garden." The count says, "You? Who?" Antonio says, "Who? You?" And Figaro says, "That surprised them, didn't it?" The count, of course, says, "I cannot believe it." And Antonio says, "When did you get so big?" Uh-oh. Count says, "I don't believe it." And Antonio says, "After you jumped, you weren't that big. Who'd have thought?" Figaro says, "Well, that's what always happens when people jump." Anyway, as we keep going through this section, and time forces us to skip through this section and move on to the next. Figaro's trying to convince everyone there during this quintet that it wasn't him, that it wasn't anyone else but him. And they manage to do that. At one point, Cherubino's name comes up, and of course the count jumps at that. But then Figaro says, well, then he would have had to ride back from Seville because he was already away. He's been sent to the garrison. And Antonio says, that can't be because I didn't see a horse jump down. So Antonio gets all confused. All right, by the end of this section, it sounds as if Figaro is on the verge of victory. He claims that, shut in the closet, waiting for his love, Susanna, he panicked when he heard the count screaming and that it was he who jumped out. And now we move to part 7 and part 8, the conclusion of this extraordinary Act 2 finale. And again, I beg your forgiveness for rushing so quickly through so much text and through skipping so much music. We simply are limited by my time with you, but I would ask you, please, to listen to the opera on your own with the translation of the libretto. Nothing can replace the quietude and singularity of your personal experience of this thing in its entirety without the interruptions that I'm providing. So let's just go on to parts 7 and 8 and finish up. So it looks... we still have quintet. It looks for all the world like Figaro's talked his way out until Antonio says, these then will be your papers that you lost. Now, we don't know yet what these papers are, but we know Cherubino dropped them and we fear the worst. Figaro has not a clue what papers this could be. The count says, here, give them to me. And Figaro says, I'm trapped. Susanna and the Countess say, Figaro, beware. And the Count says, tell me, Figaro, what are these papers? Figaro, of course, is going to stall. Just a moment. I have so many. Wait, you know, the amazing Figaro will now try to figure out what these papers are. The music is slow and deliberate as the Count smells an opportunity to trap Figaro, and Figaro must slow the action so he has time to think. Antonio says, perhaps it's a list of your debts. And Figaro says back, no, it's a list of innkeepers, more likely. The count says to Figaro, speak up. Well? Countess. Heavens, it's the page's commission. She's the first to see that it's the sealess commission. The Count says, well? So Susanna says, aside to Figaro, it's the commission. The Count says, come now. And Figaro says, oh, what a head. It's the commission that the boy gave me a while ago. Count, why did he do that? Figaro, it needs. The Count says, it needs. The Countess says, the seal. Susanna says, the seal. The Count says, answer. Figaro says, it's usual. It's usual to seal the document. Oh, thank goodness this kind of word of mouth across the stage has finally gotten to Figaro, and he's answered properly. And a gentle cadence would seem to confirm that the problems are over, but they're not, because a sudden burst from the orchestra accompanies the unceremonious entrance of Marcellino, Basilio, and Bartolo. During this whole caper we just read through, Antonio had exited, so we'd been back down to quartet, and now we're up to septet with three more people on stage. And, of course, Marcellina is just what the Count ordered. Marcellina, Basilio, and Bartolo reveal the debt that Figaro owes to Marcellina. Figaro does not want to have to pay this debt. The Count says, we're going to have a court case, and we're going to have to try this. And so a whole new series of dialogues go on. Of course, Susanna, the Countess, and Figaro are saying, why listen to these blockheads? They are fools. But, of course, Marcellina, Basilio, and Bartolo make their case. And the finale ends with Marcellino, Basilio, the Count, and Bartolo saying, what a fine stroke. How wonderful. It would seem that the marriage is undoing itself right now because Marcellina will insist on having her day in court, and if Figaro loses, on having Figaro. Please, let's at least start section 7 and perhaps hear all of 8.
Dunque saran queste carte che per
me... Alla, portiglia a me, sono in trappola.
Figaro detto, Figaro detto.
Dici un po', questo foglio cos'è? Tosto, mio tanti, aspettate.
Sarà forse il sommario dei debiti?
No, la lista degli osti. Parlate e tu lascialo. Lasciami e parli.
Parto sì, ma se torno troppo.
Lasciami, vanne, vanne, non temo di te.
Parto sì, ma se torno troppo.
Yeah. non senza schiava sì. Di coniun perché di fare, di coniun perché di fare.
Io son qui per giudicare.
Io da lei scelto avvocato vengo a far le sue difese, le legittime pretensioni vengo a palesare.
Oh, silenzio, silenzio, silenzio. Io son qui per giudicare.
Io con uomo al mondo cognito vengo qui per testimonio del promesso matrimonio di prestatati da nazzo.
Contratto leggeremo, tutto in ordine deve andare.
This is miraculous music, balancing this number of forces, having all of these different worldviews expressed simultaneously, giving everyone their say and making it all come together as a holistic entity. It's impossible, and yet Mozart pulls it off. Really extraordinary. Now look, this continuous sequence of solos and duets, trios, quartets, quintets, ultimately septets that comprise this finale offered Mozart the sort of opportunity for melodic and harmonic development ordinarily associated with symphonies and concerti and string quartets. Truly, for its speed, its degree of contrast, the continuous dramatic line and development and harmonic plan, only a great symphonist or a great composer of concerti or string quartets could have written something like this finale. Joseph Kerman writes, "It should be emphasized that the drama of the marriage of Figaro is Mozart's, not Beaumarchais and not de Ponte's. Music here does not merely decorate what the playwright or librettist has designed. Mozart's music creates a drama that they never suspected." And that's a wonderful and pointed point. William Mann wrote, "In this finale, Mozart and de Ponte invented genuine music drama, something that Peri, Monteverdi, Vivaldi, and Handel, and the rest, including Gluck, from which, of course, from whom Mozart had learned so much, had not achieved at this level. The characters and the situations are credible as well as amusing, sometimes even touching. The words are worth hearing, and we can understand them. The music goes on revealing new subtleties, new truth. The more frequent it is heard, and the more frequently we study it. Granted, to play favorites is infantile when works of art are concerned. However, when people insist on playing favorites about music. The second act finale of Figaro claims a prior place on the list. It is second to nothing. All right, the remainder of the opera, well, one glory follows another. It's during the third act trial, when Marcellina wants her contract honored, that it's discovered that Figaro is actually the long-lost illegitimate son of Marcellina and Dr. Bartolo. It's such a kick. The look on the Count's face, oh, you could knock him down with a feather. In the fourth act finale, we have a chunk of music that stands second only to the second act finale. In it, the Count's intrigues are exposed, and in as magical a passage as has ever been created, he begs forgiveness from the Countess, and she grants it. It's a moment of profound redemption. It's as if we've all been forgiven our sins and reconciled to our loved ones. Now, in conclusion, I would point out something. Mozart's operas are not easy listening. They require our total involvement, just as the dramas and comedies of Shakespeare, Ibsen, and Stoppard require our total involvement. In Mozart's time, his operas were not considered easy listening. They were, for many, too long, too melodically varied, and too harmonically complex. One recalls that famous conversation between the Emperor Franz Joseph and Mozart following the Vienna premiere of Mozart's The Abduction from the Harem in 1782. Emperor Franz Joseph said, "Too fine for our ears and an immense number of notes, my dear Mozart." And Mozart's famous response, "Just as many notes, Your Majesty, as are required." Mozart's characters live and breathe. They're never mere archetypes. Mozart's operas seem quite modern to our ears today because he imbues his characters with such an incredible range of moods, emotion, subtlety, unconscious motivation. In a word, he gives his characters humanity. Brahms wrote of The Marriage of Figaro, "Every number in Figaro is a marvel. I simply can't understand how anyone could create anything so perfect. Such a thing has never been done before, not even by Beethoven." Joseph Kerman wrote that it's difficult to discuss Mozart's great operas without lapsing into platitudes. "The vindication of opera as drama comes in occasional, unique triumphs. And among these, Mozart has left our most precious examples." We save our last word, our last Mozartian platitude, for Joachino Rossini, whose own Barber of Seville we will meet in our next lectures. Rossini wrote this, "The Germans have always been, at all times, the greatest harmonists, and the Italians, the greatest melodists. But the moment the North produced Mozart, we of the South were beaten on our own ground, because this man rises above all nations, uniting in himself the charm of Italian melody and all the profundity of German harmony. Mozart is the only musician who had as much knowledge as genius, and as much genius as knowledge." Thank you very much. Welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 17, the first of a two-lecture set entitled The Bel Canto Style and Rossini's The Barber of Seville. First, a discussion on the nature of early 19th century Italian opera. By the early 19th century, opera in Italy had become a universally popular art and entertainment. Not just in the big cities, as it had always been a popular entertainment, or at least since the 1650s or so, and I'm talking about Naples and Rome and Florence and Venice, but now the popularity of opera had spread to the small towns and the small cities up and down the Italian peninsula. J. Merrill Knapp tells us, "In addition to the large cities, there were operatic performances in almost every town of any size in the Italian peninsula. Much of this popularity was attributable to the rise of opera buffa, which the common man could laugh at and enjoy without pretension. Intellectually, it made no great demands and was ideally suited to the Italian genius for wit, gaiety, sparkling dialogue, attractive tunes, and comic situations. Sunshine and the sap of life were embedded in the music and the plot.
Composers like Giovanni Paisiello and Domenico Cimarosa were masters in musical characterization, deft orchestration, and lilting melodies. Their operas were known not only in Italy, but throughout Europe. Opera seria continued to survive, but mostly under aristocratic patronage in the larger cities. So, by the early 19th century, Italian opera had become a major commercial enterprise, a conservative, highly profitable media industry. Now, the commercial nature of this Italian opera has a good side and a bad side. So I submit for your consideration two opposing views of the relative merits of this early 19th century Italian opera. First, the upside, and as always, when we need an upside, we turn to opera historian Donald Grout, who's been our Italian opera Pollyanna throughout. And I quote, "Italian opera in the 19th century came out of an established tradition, healthily grounded in the life of the nation. Italy was less susceptible than northern countries to the seductions of the Romantic movement, and composers there were less tempted to try new and radical experiments. Romantic elements permeated Italian opera only gradually and never to the same degree as in Germany and France. Moreover, opera was the only important Italian musical outlet in the 19th century, so that the genius of the nation was largely concentrated on this one genre, and such a situation also tended to encourage a conservative attitude. So, opera is healthily grounded in the life of the Italian nation." What Grout is saying is that opera in early 19th century Italy is a true popular art, with the attendant and necessary simplification of harmonic language and character development, in favor, always in favor, of beautiful pop-type melodies and a predictable comic and dramatic situational setup. All right, the downside. We will let that be expressed by contemporary Hector Berlioz, the wonderful French composer, who wrote, around 1835 or 1840 or so, quote, "Music, meaning opera for the Italians, is a sensual pleasure and nothing more. For this noble expression of the mind, they hardly have more respect than for the art of cooking. They want a score that, like a plate of macaroni, can be assimilated immediately without their having to think about it or even pay attention to it," unquote. So according to Berlioz, opera is a sensual pleasure for the Italians and nothing more. Now, of course, Berlioz bemoans just those elements that Grout celebrates, the popular nature of Italian opera and its attendant directness and simplicity here at the beginning of the 19th century. Look, whatever, like it or not, the style of these popular, predominantly buffa Italian operas is based on the deep-rooted Italian conviction that opera is, in essence, the highest manifestation of song, and that its primary purpose is to delight, entertain, and move the hearer with music that's melodious, unsentimental, and spontaneous, that is, in every sense of the word, popular. The style of these early 19th century Italian operas is called bel canto. Bel canto. This means beautiful singing, and by extension, it also means beautiful melody, beautiful song opera. The principal composers of this so-called bel canto opera are Gaetano Donizetti. Donizetti lived from 1797 to 1848. Donizetti wrote a lot, my friends. 70 operas. 70 operas. Let's just let that number wash around and through for a moment. 70 complete operas. Oh, my goodness. 100 songs, several symphonies, oratorios, cantatas, chamber works, etc. One wonders when he ate and slept. Vincenzo Bellini, the second of the great bel canto triumvirate. Bellini lived from 1801 to 1835, but 34 years, and where Donizetti wrote much, Bellini wrote few. 10 opere serie and one opera buffa, that is, La Sonnambula. And the third of the great bel canto composers, of course, is our Gioachino Rossini. Rossini was born in 1792, and he died in 1868. He wrote 35 operas, and they were written between 1810, when he was 18 years old, and 1829, when he was 37 years old. And the last opera is William Tell, and then he quit. Fini. Done. I've had enough. He retires at 37 and never writes another opera. Now, Rossini's critics have branded him a lazy exploiter of popular taste who made a lot of money, married a rich widow, retired young to Paris, there to indulge his prodigious tastes in food, wine, and French women. However, it has now become clear, and we must be fair to Signor Rossini, we must remember that he probably indeed did suffer from debilitating mental illness. He had severe depression, which only got worse as he got older. The depression was aggravated by phobias of all sorts, by hypochondria, and probably by gonorrhea. So he was a sick man. He was very mentally ill, and this illness became progressive, getting much worse as he got older. Eric Plaut points out that after age 37, Rossini never wrote another opera. From age 40 to 50, he didn't write any music at all. After that, he wrote only religious music and small pieces, mostly songs. Such abandonment of one's primary creative medium is unique among composers. Rossini's psychiatric illness cost the world untold operatic riches. And with that, we must agree, and it's something we must rue. But we also have to be grateful for those operas he did leave us with. A few words, my friends, regarding the business of 19th century Italian bel canto opera. Harold Schoenberg tells us, oh, before I even read this Schoenberg quote, I just want to talk again about this idea of the composer. This is something I mentioned in a previous lecture, but would re-mention now. We tend to see composers as these people who are responding constantly to a kind of artistic call of nature. A composer looks at the moon and writes a moonlight sonata. You know, we have someone who basically doesn't know the basics of personal hygiene and yet is capable of writing an opera at a single sitting. Look, we've talked about how extraordinary Mozart was as a craftsperson and how Mozart could write with effortless ease the most complex operas, but that's a fairly special thing. We've got to remember that composers are work people. They're craftspeople. There are techniques that composers rely on that have nothing to do with inspiration, but have to do with construction and building ideas. And so a good composer is not just a gifted musician. A good composer is a technician who knows how to push notes around. I mention this because I want you to understand what I'm about to tell you in context. I'm about to tell you how quickly these Italian opera composers wrote operas and how many operas they were expected to turn out with great rapidity. And it might seem stunning to us that these operas could be written so quickly. And to a degree, it is stunning. But we've got to remember, there were tried and true techniques. There were all kinds of shortcuts. There were all kinds of Yahtzees and traditions that composers could rely on. Just the way, oh, let's say a journalist knows when they sit down to write a 1,000-word piece, that there are certain expectations. I lead with this, I follow with that, I do this, and then I recap and I close. So there are compositional processes that if you are very familiar with them and well-versed in your craft, you can turn out a lot really quickly, as long as you don't seek to be original. Originality requires time. But putting out stock material does not. Now, I read you this Harold Schoenberg quote, which will begin to tell us about the business of early 19th century Italian bel canto opera. The composer would arrive at an opera house, compose an opera in 3 weeks or so, conduct the first three performances, and then move on to the next town. It was a business, and the faster the turnover, the better. Seldom were the operas published, and Rossini, for one, knowing that the next town would not have heard his last opera, would calmly appropriate sections from it and pass it off as new. Rossini's most famous opera, The Barber of Seville of 1816, uses arias and ensembles from Le Cambiale di Matrimonio of 1810, and in addition, material from four other of his previously composed operas. Even the now famous overture was lifted from a previous work. it was typical that the barber took the composer no more than 13 days to complete. I always knew Rossini was a lazy man, joked Donizetti when told of this feat. Donizetti knew whereof he spoke, for it had taken him no more than 8 days to compose the Elixir of Love. Yes, Norman Lebrecht fills us in on the details of Donizetti and the Elixir. A Milanese theater director had been let down by another composer and desperately needed a new opera in 2 weeks. He begged Gaetano Donizetti to revamp an existing opera by the composer who had let him down. "Are you making fun of me?" Donizetti said. "I'm not accustomed to patching up even my own old operas, let alone one by another composer. I'll give you a new opera in 14 days. Now send to me Felice Romani." Felice Romani was the preeminent librettist at this time in Italy. "I give you 1 week to prepare the libretto," Donizetti told Romani. "It must be set to music within 14 days. Let's see which of us has more guts," unquote. Yes, the fruit of this challenge was the opera, The Elixir of Love, which is one of the most pleasant and sparkling of all the bel canto operas. Felix Mendelssohn, a German composer, traveling in Italy, looked, marveled, and was amused at the Italian way of composing. "Donizetti," Mendelssohn wrote, "finishes an opera in 10 days. It may be hissed, to be sure, but that doesn't matter, as it's paid for all the same, and then he can go about having a good time. If in the end his reputation should be endangered, in that case he would have to work real hard, which he wouldn't like at all. Therefore, he sometimes spends as much as 3 weeks writing an opera, taking pains with a couple of the arias in it so that he may please the public, and then he can afford to amuse himself once more and once more write trash," unquote. Well, thank you, Mr. Mendelssohn. How pleasant. In a letter to a fellow composer, Rossini was devastatingly frank about his method of composition. And now I quote Rossini. "Wait until the evening before opening night. Nothing primes inspiration more than necessity, whether it be the presence of a copyist waiting for your work or the prodding of an impresario tearing at his hair. In my time, all the impresarios of Italy were bald by 30. I wrote the overture to La Gazza Ladra the day of its opening in the theater itself, where I was imprisoned by the director and under the direct surveillance of the stagehands, who were instructed to throw my original text through the window, page by page, to the copyists waiting down below. If I did not compose quickly enough, the stagehands were instructed to throw me out the window instead. I did a little better with The Barber of Seville. I did not even compose an overture for it, but selected for it one which had been written for an opera called Elisabetta. The public was none the wiser and completely satisfied." Yes, what Rossini did not add was that he had used the Barber overture for his Aureliano and his L'Equivocato Stravagante in addition to Elisabetta. So he used that same overture 4 different times. Of course, we don't know it as the overture to Elisabetta or Aureliano or L'Equivocato Stravagante. We know it as the overture to The Barber of Seville, despite the fact that it is the 4th opera that it overtures. Let's sample the beginning of the overture and get ourselves in the Rossinian spirit of music, shall we? Overture, Barber of Seville, first couple of minutes.
Thank you.
We are ready to proceed with Rossini's The Barber of Seville. First, its gestation and performance background. And we begin with a letter from Giuseppe Verdi to Camille Balagueux from 1898. Verdi writes, "You may say things about Rossini, and they may be true regarding borrowings and speed of composition and harmonic simplicity and so forth, but I confess that I cannot help believing The Barber of Seville, for abundance of ideas, for comic verve, and for truth of declamation, the most beautiful opera buffa in existence." Verdi's seal of approval, my friends, is as close to God as one will get here on this earth. The Barber is almost universally considered, along with the Mozart Da Ponte, Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, and Così fan tutte, and Verdi's own Falstaff, one of the great opera buffa. Rossini's contract for The Barber of Seville was typical of its time. Rossini was 24 years old when he composed the piece. He had to accept the libretto chosen by the impresario. He had to agree to any and all modifications requested by the singers. Yes, the singers are still of preeminent importance in Italian opera. He had to lodge with the baritones so that the impresario could keep an eye on him. He had to be present for the rehearsals and the first three performances. Dates were specified for the completion of the first act and for opening night, and compensation was set at the equivalent of about $200 plus a coat with gold buttons. Oh, well, gold buttons, good, thank goodness. I mean, we were worried he was going to be underpaid for this opera. The libretto chosen for Rossini, The Barber of Seville, was written by Cesare Sterbini, based on the play, of course, by Pierre Augustin Caron de Beaumarchais. The Barber of Seville, as we've talked about, was the first of a trilogy of plays written and produced in Paris between 1772 and 1792 about Figaro, Rossina, Count Almaviva, and so forth. Now, the other plays are The Marriage of Figaro, which was the second play, and then a third play from 1792 called The Guilty Mother. Now, when we did the Mozart Marriage of Figaro, I did not mention the third play, The Guilty Mother, because it was written in 1792 after Mozart and Da Ponte had done their Marriage of Figaro. But by the time Rossini does his Barber of Seville, Beaumarchais has created a trilogy of three plays, of which this is the first. Now, as we've already discussed, again, in a previous lecture, these revolutionary French plays, of which The Marriage of Figaro is certainly the most incendiary in terms of social commentary, these revolutionary French plays were based on character archetypes drawn from the Italian Commedia dell'arte. David Kimball explains. Commedia dell'arte troupes had performed in Paris as far back as the 16th century, that's the 1500s. Early in the reign of Louis XIV, in 1660, they had become so popular that an Italian theater was actually established in Paris. This survived on and off for a century, until in 1762 it was merged with the Opera Comique. The influence of the Italian Commedia dell'arte on French culture was incalculable. Molière's comic art is rooted in it. Some of Watteau's most haunting images were inspired by it. And even in its 18th century decline, it continued to fascinate and stimulate dramatists, especially Marivaux and Beaumarchais. The Barber of Seville was first turned into an opera by composer Giovanni Paisiello and librettist Giuseppe Petrocellini in 1782. Again, David Kimball relates. In 1816, when Rossini's opera had its premiere at the Teatro Argentina in Rome, Paisiello, a notoriously touchy man, was still alive, and his barber was still considered the classic of the Italian repertoire. Rossini, therefore, took the precaution of writing the venerable old master, and now I quote Rossini, "I declared to him that I had not wanted to enter into a contest with him, being aware of my inferiority, but had wanted only to treat a subject that had delighted me, while avoiding as much as possible the exact situations that existed in his libretto, unquote. Now, in the libretto that was printed and distributed to the audience at the first performances of Rossini's Barber, Rossini's librettist, Cesare Sturbini, made the same points, but even in greater detail. So what I'm about to read you was actually printed in the libretti, handed out to the opening night audiences. Monsieur Beaumarchais's comedy is performed in Rome, arranged as a comic drama entitled Almaviva, or The Useless Precaution. And this is an important point. When The Barber of Seville by Rossini was first performed, it wasn't called The Barber of Seville. It was called Almaviva, or The Useless Precaution. Sturbini explains why. Out of consideration for the feelings of respect and veneration which animate the composer of this music towards the so celebrated Paisiello, who has already treated this subject under its original title. So out of respect to Paisiello, Rossini and Sturbini weren't going to call their piece The Barber of Seville. Again, Sturbini continues. Called upon to undertake this difficult task, Maestro Gioacchino Rossini, so as not to incur the reproach of a temerarious rivalry with the immortal author who preceded him, has expressly requested that The Barber of Seville should be versified entirely anew, and that a number of new situations should be added for musical pieces such are required by modern theatrical taste, which has changed so much since the period in which the renowned Paisiello wrote his music. Look, both Sturbini in print to the opening night's audiences, because this libretto would have been distributed for weeks, not just at the premiere, and then Rossini's letter to Paisiello himself, both Sturbini and Rossini are trying to avoid the obvious. They're trying to avoid seeming that they're in competition with the Paisiello version and that they're being disrespectful towards Paisiello. We know that this issue of respect is very important, particularly in Mediterranean countries. And disrespect they did not want to show towards Paisiello. So all of these preemptive apologies were meant to avoid trouble. Didn't do any good, my friends. The premiere on February 20th of 1816 was un disastro, una calamità, un catastrophe, a scandal, a fiasco. I tell you the story. A pro-Paisiello, anti-Rossini clique assembled at their posts around the theater as soon as the doors were opened. By comparison, Rossini's claque was small and timid. The performance got off to a bad start, and the hissing and whistling began immediately, said one eyewitness, that is Castile Blaze, quote, all the whistlers in Italy seem to have been given themselves a rendezvous for this performance, unquote. When the curtain fell on the first act, Rossini turned towards the audience, shrugged his shoulders slightly, and then slowly applauded them, the audience. Now, of course, the audience took this as a sign of utter contempt from Rossini. Apparently, not a single note of the second act could be heard above the din of hissing and whistling. Look, much ado about niente. Rossini's Barber of Seville is vastly superior to Paisiello's at virtually every level, a superiority that was recognized almost immediately. Like, how about at the second performance two nights later, where it was roundly applauded and greeted with almost mad joy. All right, The Barber of Seville, characters and storyline. Here's our game plan for the remainder of this lecture and the entirety of the next. We'll meet the main characters through those arias which most define them. We will also listen to these arias as an example of Rossini's brilliant bel canto usage. We will also, as an example of Rossini's comic art, listen to a portion of the famous music lesson scene. Now, as we go, we'll come to grips with those musical elements that make this a bel canto style opera. So, quickly, story, character outline. Rossina, this is a different Rossina than we met in The Marriage of Figaro. This is the young and vivacious Rossina, 16 years old, witty, a total babe, if you'll excuse me, desperate for fun and romance. She is the ward of Dr. Bartolo, guardian of Rossina, ponderous, pompous, nasty old fogey. Yes, is the same as what we've met before. He intends to marry Rosina himself for her inheritance. Count Almaviva, a young nobleman desperately in love with Rosina, passing as a love-struck soldier named Lindoro. And Figaro, Count Almaviva's former valet, now a sort of jack-of-all-trades, a factotum, living in Seville, where the action of this opera takes place. Count Almaviva is the first of the main characters we meet. So let us set the scene, please. Act 1, Scene 1. Just before sunrise, a small piazza in Seville with narrow streets running off in all directions. Dr. Bartolo's house is at center stage. It has a small balcony overlooking the piazza directly above the front door. Introduction. Fiorello, servant to Count Almaviva, enters slowly, surveying the scene, urging his hired musicians to follow him. The Count enters wrapped in a cloak. Following some preliminaries, the Count and his band position themselves directly underneath that balcony. The musicians tune their instruments and the Count sings, accompanied by them. All right, we hear a loudly proclaimed exclamation point in the band, and then this rustic band plays a delightful intro featuring guitar and sistrum. Sistrum would be these tinkling bells, a series of bells held on a branch-like piece of wood, and when you shake it, they tinkle. The Count sings a ravishing Neapolitan-flavored serenade, love song. Please, he sounds, for my ear, like an Italian Der Bingel, crooning these lovely melismas. A melisma is a musical idea where you have many different notes attached to one syllable, and it has the crooning sound of a serenade. He is clearly in love, but with who we don't yet know. And here's what he sings. Low in the smiling sky, the lovely dawn is breaking, and you are not awake, and you are still asleep. Arise, my sweetest love, O come, my treasured one. Soften the pain, O God, of the dart which pierces me. Now, I'm not sure I want to wake up listening to this guy, but I suppose that this is the 19th century equivalent to a radio alarm clock going off set to a music channel. In any case, let's listen to this opening aria. I'm almost loath to call it an aria. It's so song-like. But an aria it is for all intents and purposes. And here's what I want you to think about while we listen to it, or at least the first half of it. What does this tell us about the Count? What does the music tell us about his personality, about his feelings, about who and what he is?
Thank you.
All right, what do we know about the Count from the very get-go? Number one, he's a lovesick sap. Number two, he's willing to spend money, great amounts of money, to get people to help him. This is how he's used to getting things done, paying others to help or do it for him. This band that we just heard didn't come cheap, I can assure you. He's a lyric tenor. This means he wears his shirts much too far open in the front, his pants are too tight, and he's not particularly intelligent. What does the music tell us about the Count? Well, it's simple, direct, sentimental, and not very sophisticated. This is a genuinely pop-style tune, and it's the first aria we hear in the opera, so it tells us a lot about the other music that we will hear in the opera. All right, the Count's serenade, sadly, expense notwithstanding, elicits no response whatsoever, and he is crestfallen. Fiorello and the musicians depart, only after having been paid and then tipped. And the Count says to himself in recitative, "She must have noticed that I come here every day at this time to see her. Oh, just see what love has done to a man of my rank. Yet, oh, she must be my bride." And then off stage he hears, coming from the distance, "La la 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 la." And the Count says, "Who is this coming now? I'll let him go by, unseen, under this archway. I can see what I want. Dawn is already here, but love is not shy." So the Count hides. Enter Figaro. Now, we first heard Figaro's entrance aria, Largo al Factotum, back in lecture number 2. It's worth hearing again. Besides, we know a good bit more about opera now than we did at that time. Okay, this classic and a wonderful comic number is the ultimate example of a buffa patter style aria. I have not explained patter style yet in the course of this course. Patter style simply means a lot of words said very quickly, and patter arias tend to be comic arias, and they tend to portray a very fast talking person doing their thing. We will hear a couple of patter style arias in the course of our quick study of The Barber of Seville, this being the first. Figaro is revealed at once as a clever, fast-talking, streetwise, and cocky character of common birth. In other words, the quintessential buffa character. It is his scheming that will provide the grease on which the plot of this opera will move forward. I would quickly read the text. Figaro enters, a guitar strapped around his neck. "La la 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 la, make way for the factotum of the city. Rushing off to his shop, for dawn is here. What a merry life, what gay pleasures for a barber of quality. Ah, bravo, Figaro, bravo, bravissimo, bravo. Most fortunate of men, indeed you are. Ready for everything by day, by night. Always in a bustle, in constant motion. A better lot for a barber, a nobler life does not exist. Razors and combs, lancets and scissors at my command, everything's ready. And then there are the extras, part of the trade, business for the ladies. And cavaliers, ah, what a merry pleasure, what gay pleasures for a barber of quality. All call for me, all want me, ladies and children, old men and maidens. I need a wig. I need a shave. Leeches to bleed me. Here, take this note. All call for me. All want me. I need a wig. I want a shave. Here, take this note. Oh, Figaro, 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 Figaro! Yes, indeed, the demands of Figaro's public pile one upon the other, becoming ever more insistent. This is portrayed by ever faster singing and one of Rossini's favorite devices, the crescendo. The music just keeps getting louder and louder, reaching a climax with Figaro singing alone, mocking all of those who call him. In the next phrase, an exasperated Figaro begs for mercy. Yes, sure, this is like a diva telling the audience to stop applauding. Heavens, heavens, what a commotion. Heavens, what a crowd. One at a time. Una alla volta, for pity's sake. Oh, Figaro, I'm here, Figaro there, Figaro up, Figaro down, Figaro qua, Figaro la, Figaro su, Figaro giù. Quicker and quicker, I move like greased lightning, make way for the factotum of the city. Another Rossini crescendo leads to another climax on Nella città of the city. And then this last incredible phrase is sung ever faster, leaving both Figaro and us, his audience, breathless. Ah, bravo, Figaro, bravo, bravissimo. On you, good fortune will always smile. I am the factotum of the city. As I asked us back in lecture two, do we like this guy? As we answered, yeah, we love this guy. He's one of us.
Il giorno sempre intorno in giro sta, il miglior...